KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It deals with the causes of conflict, not just the results of conflict.
The U.S. Institute of Peace is all about soft power.
It's been a pillar of American foreign policy. Is the Trump administration giving up on it?
For Wednesday, March 19th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsie Chang. Ahead this hour, President Trump is seeking to fire the Democratic members of the Federal Trade Commission.
If the president can remove FTC commissioners, he can remove members of the Fed.
Also, watching for an Alaska volcano to explode.
And tomorrow marks the first day of spring.
Cannot come soon enough. We've got new poetry about the changing season.
I anticipate spring from the moment fall starts happening.
Plus, a new book from our colleague, longtime China correspondent, Emily Fang.
Let only red flowers bloom. That's ahead after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Israeli military says it has launched a new ground offensive in Gaza, sending troops back into areas that they'd retreated from during a nearly two-month ceasefire. It comes a day after Israel broke the ceasefire with a series of airstrikes that killed more than 400 Palestinians, including many children, and wounded hundreds more. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
In a statement, the Israeli military called it a, quote, targeted ground operation, saying the aim is to expand what it calls the security perimeter, separating the enclave from southern Israel. The actions come as Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz released a video statement addressed to, quote, Gaza residents. Speaking in Hebrew with Arabic subtitles, Katz said the video was the, quote, final warning to return all the hostages and remove Hamas from power. What comes next will be much harsher, and you will bear the full consequences, he said, warning of more evacuation orders. He said that Israel will, quote, act with force beyond anything you have ever seen. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A North Dakota jury has found Greenpeace must pay hundreds of millions of dollars to a pipeline company. NPR's Alejandro Barunda reports the case stems from protests over the Dakota Access oil pipeline nearly a decade ago.
Greenpeace members and thousands of others participated in months-long protests led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. Energy Transfer, the company that built the pipeline, claimed that Greenpeace defamed them, trespassed, and helped others to do so, and damaged the company's reputation. The jury agreed, assigning damages of more than $650 million. Sushma Raman is the interim executive director of Greenpeace USA. She says the lawsuit was an intimidation tactic that could have a chilling effect on protests even outside the environmental movement.
All of it should be a cause of concern to people who participate in peaceful protests, who organize advocacy efforts, who show up in solidarity.
Greenpeace plans to appeal the verdict. Alejandro Burunda, NPR News.
More Americans are taking prescriptions for ADHD than ever before, and some are misusing the medicines. That's according to a new study from JAMA Psychiatry. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
During the pandemic, many adults started taking stimulants for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The researchers who conducted this study looked at how people are using these drugs in light of this new demand. They underscored that most people do use stimulants safely and effectively and emphasized that it's important to keep them widely available. However, they did also find that more than 25% of adults with a prescription reported misuse. That means taking too much of a drug or too often or any other ways their doctor did not prescribe. This kind of behavior is correlated with substance use disorder of other kinds that can be quite dangerous. The researchers called for careful monitoring of people using these drugs. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 383 points today. You're listening to NPR. As President Trump continues to try to get Ukraine and Russia to agree to discuss ending their now three-year-old war prompted by Russia's invasion, Trump today spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Trump described it as a good telephone call that would be a sharp contrast from the fiery Oval Office meeting the two world leaders had just a few weeks ago, where Trump lectured Zelensky. According to the White House, the two agreed on a partial ceasefire for energy infrastructure. Trump also suggested the U.S. take ownership of Ukrainian power plants to ensure their security. Miami Beach's mayor has dropped an effort to evict and defund an art cinema after the theater refused to cancel screenings of this year's Oscar-winning documentary. NPR's Greg Allen reports the mayor backed off after strong opposition from the community and other elected officials.
The film No Other Land tells the story of a Palestinian town in the West Bank that was bulldozed by the Israeli government for use as a military training zone. Miami Beach's mayor objected to its screening at an arts theater that leased space in a city-owned building. At a meeting in Miami Beach, City Commissioner Alex Fernandez was one of many who said he supported the cinema.
The First Amendment is clear. Governments must never censor artistic expression, even when it is controversial or deeply offensive.
Miami Beach's mayor said he believes the film contains anti-Semitic propaganda, but agreed to withdraw the eviction and defunding measure. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Crude oil futures prices followed stocks higher today. That was on some new government data showing demand for fuel picking up. Oil rose 26 cents a barrel to settle at $67.16 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Let's revisit a dramatic scene that just unfolded at the United States Institute of Peace. That is a congressionally funded think tank here in Washington. The White House says the Institute's acting president and CEO George Moose was fired last week, along with most of the board, for failing to comply with an executive order that effectively dismantles the USIP. Well, Moose has challenged his dismissal, and this Monday he was holed up in his office when, he says, DOGE staffers broke into the building, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. DC police helped escort Moose outside, which is where our colleague Michelle Kellerman caught up with him, standing outside on the steps of the institute he had run until just a few days before. George Moose told Michelle it was a sad day for the Institute and its mission to prevent conflict around the world.
And I have to believe that in the long term, that purpose, that mission will be reaffirmed and that we will, in one way or another, be allowed to continue it.
I want to talk through that mission with someone who sponsored the legislation to create the USIP. Former Democratic Congressman from Kansas, also former Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman. Secretary Glickman, welcome.
Thank you, Mary Louise. A pleasure to be with you.
What went through your mind this week as you watched a hostile takeover of the USIP?
Well, I think the actions of the DOGE group of the administration were unconscionable in my view. I was very involved in the creation of this organization, not the only sponsor, but the lead House sponsor back in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And in my case, I came from central Kansas, where there were a large number of Mennonites who wanted to see the United States establish a peace academy, kind of like a military academy. Mm-hmm. So we worked on that for years and years, and ultimately it was decided that instead of an academy, an institute that would try to promote conflict resolution techniques, try to deal with extremism in the world, and try to do our best to assert American power responsibly, along with other soft power aspects of the American government, including USAID and the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and, you know, and other things. And so it worked. I thought it's worked very well.
I mean, at the risk of oversimplifying, because obviously a lot of things go into what prevents or enables a conflict, but is there a specific example you would point us to where the USIP played a role in helping to avert a conflict?
I think in South Asia, in the Middle East, certainly in the entire continent of Africa, there have been all sorts of ways where we have tried to improve the governance systems of the countries to make it so that their systems are much more stable. USIP will contract with various organizations, including the U.S. military, to try to deal with these problems as they occur.
So, to the Trump administration's stated concern, take that head on. Why should Congress fund a think tank? I mean, what's the need in a town where there is no shortage of think tanks, plenty of which get by on private funding?
Well, and those think tanks that do a very good job, but this is kind of unique. Imagine, you know, we have this big building in downtown Washington near the State Department. It says U.S. Institute of Peace, and its goal is to promote peace and conflict resolution around the world. It works with the State Department, but it's a wonderful thing that the United States not only has this great military establishment, the Defense Department does a spectacular job, but also has an entity that it deals with the causes of conflict, not just the results of conflict.
If I'm hearing you right, your argument boils down to the U.S. should fund this using taxpayer money because it directly benefits the United States?
It directly benefits the United States. It establishes our influence as engaged in the world. We work with other governments in this regard. It doesn't have the restrictions that a lot of the bureaucracies have in State Department and the Defense Department, but it does work with them as well. And in the big scheme of things, when we're talking about spending close to $1 trillion a year on our military, that we're spending, you know, a tiny, tiny percentage of that funding to try to deal in advance with the causes of conflict, the causes of extremism, and trying to prevent those bad things from happening, which ultimately may lead us into war.
So, Secretary Glickman, if the USIP is scaled back, if it outright disappears, what might be the impact?
Well, first of all, I hope it's not disappearing. There is no entity of government that should escape scrutiny, so I want to make that clear. And I think the USIP is probably shouldn't escape scrutiny either. But if it's gone, then we lose the opportunity to make the case for conflict resolution and peaceful ways to resolve these conflicts before war occurs, before death occurs. And, you know, you're not always successful. But in many cases, you move the ball forward. And it's the United States of America that's moving the ball forward. So you take this USIP, you add all the stuff that the Agency for International Development does, you add all the stuff that the Voice of America does to try to project America's influence around the world. This is part of our soft power. We need hard power, too. We desperately need our government to have an adequate military, but we also need soft power. And by the way, this was created in a very bipartisan atmosphere. I remember how it was created. It was added to the Defense Authorization Bill. And so it's one of the few things that we've had bipartisanship on in this area.
It is indeed true that both Republican and Democratic lawmakers pushed to create this institute. It prompts a bigger question, though, which is, can the U.S. Institute of Peace, can any institution truly be nonpartisan in such a hyperpartisan moment?
Well, that's a problem we all have right now. I mean, how does the Congress work in this moment that we're dealing with? And, you know, back in the historic period when I was in the Congress, it was more bipartisan than it is now. And I wish that we had a lot of that same environment that we did back then. But yes, it can do some good. I don't think it does any harm at all. It can do some good. We have potential conflicts around the world. And, you know, this is an area where we have a lot of competitors. So if we're not involved in this, it either doesn't happen or countries like China and North Korea and Iran and Russia are involved. China's influence around the world in the soft power area has grown rather significantly in the last several years. And so, in my judgment, it deserves scrutiny like every other agency, but let's do it the right way.
That's former Democratic Congressman Dan Glickman. He was the principal House sponsor of legislation which led to the creation of the U.S. Institute of Peace back in 1984. Dan Glickman, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
2 months into President Trump's second term, Democrats on Capitol Hill are still struggling over how to mount a more effective opposition. When it comes to some of their biggest worries, like questions about presidential power and the rule of law, House Democrats have put their trust in Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin. As the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, Raskin is in the thick of many of these fights that are key to Trump's agenda. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin has seen plenty of political showdowns in his nearly decade-long career in Washington. But as the House Judiciary Committee's top Democrat, he's facing his biggest challenge yet in a fight against President Trump's Republican Party.
our job on the Democratic side to try to challenge them to stand with us to uphold the rule of law at a very dangerous moment in American history.
It's an uphill battle. Raskin's party remains fragile, hoping to rebuild after last year's election losses. This, as Trump is upending constitutional norms and congressional powers, with Republicans more united behind him than ever before.
First is reconciliation and fundamental design to improve our immigration system and secure our border. And then, of course, Pam Bondi, Todd Blanche, Kash Patel, work with them to get answers to some of the oversight concerns we had over the years.
That's House Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan boasting about his committee's plans. And while Jordan and Raskin have co-sponsored bipartisan legislation, the Ohio Republican knows his Democratic counterpart is up for a fight.
You appreciate a worthy opponent. I'm sure there's going to be some robust debate.
Raskin is a former constitutional law professor who draws accolades from both sides of the aisle. That includes retired North Carolina Republican Congressman Patrick McHenry.
He's a tough operator. He's somebody to watch closely as an effective warrior against the Trump administration.
McHenry has been in Raskin's position, trying to lead his party on a committee while in the minority. He describes the role as three things: important, limited, and awkward.
You spend most of your time trying to make a point the broader public will hear, and most of the time they don't hear.
And he compares it to sitting next to a bus driver.
The bus driver's in control. You can help direct them in key moments, or you could be a crank and just yell at the bus driver.
Raskin is trying to do more than just yell. He's working to shape House Democrats' legal strategy against the expansion of presidential power, beginning with a legal brief in a case against Trump efforts to dismantle portions of the federal government. Democrats say it's the first filing of many. Raskin is also focused on counter-programming. When Trump visited the Justice Department earlier this month, Raskin was outside sparring with the president's supporters and decrying moves to fire prosecutors.
They're firing the best criminal prosecutors in Washington because they did their jobs.
So far, judiciary Democrats like Vermont Congresswoman Becca Ballant says Raskin has made them more formidable.
And we can have deep discussions about strategy and tactic, but also the law itself.
Raskin says he'll draw from his time as the House Oversight Panel's top Democrat, where he defended against efforts to impeach former President Joe Biden. He argues his party's fight must be informed by the success of past movements that have shaped the country.
They provide us a lot of hope, but we also have to maintain the memory of the struggles that they went through, and that should make us tough.
If they're successful, the fight could inject new momentum for a House Democratic caucus that, like the rest of the party, hopes to regain their political footing. Claudia DeSalles, NPR News, The Capitol.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A volcano 80 miles west of Alaska's largest city is more likely than not going to explode. That's according to a recent announcement from researchers who say that Mount Spur will likely erupt in the coming weeks or months. As Wesley Early with Alaska Public Media reports, the potential eruption has Anchorage emergency officials preparing for ashfall in their communities.
Carrie Wiedeker was at her parents' potato farm in Palmer, about 40 miles north of Anchorage, when Mount Spur last erupted in 1992.
And I remember that summer really clearly because my parents had to wear masks and goggles throughout harvesting because of all the volcanic ash would get stirred up.
Now, more than 30 years later, Wiedeker is Anchorage's disaster recovery coordinator, and she's working to prepare the community for another Spur eruption. Scientists with the Alaska Volcano Observatory have been monitoring Spur for almost a year and announced last week that an eruption is likely.
It's almost like we have a checklist of the usual signs that volcanoes give us before they progress to an eruption.
Matt Haney is scientist in charge at the observatory and says that checklist includes small quakes near the volcano, the inflation of the surface outwards, melting of snow, and an increase in gases venting from the peak.
All four of those are giving us those indicators.
He says the volcano has erupted twice before in recorded history, once in 1953 and again in 1992. Haney says if the eruption happens, it would likely look similar.
More often than not, we have explosive eruptions that fragment magma and shoot ash, 50,000 feet into the atmosphere.
They estimate an explosion could last a few hours and produce ash clouds that could travel hundreds of miles. Spur is fairly remote, and Haney says there's little infrastructure there beyond the Alaska Volcano Observatory monitoring stations. But winds could still carry the ash to Anchorage and smaller south-central Alaska communities. Wiedeker, the local emergency official, says she's been monitoring the forecast for weeks, and sometimes the wind isn't blowing toward them.
But then I looked it up yesterday, and sure enough, it was straight over Anchorage. So it really depends a lot on the weather that day.
If the ash does make its way to Anchorage, it could shut down Anchorage's main airport. In 1992, the airport was closed for 20 hours due to risks ash presented to airplane engines and exteriors. It also poses a threat to people with respiratory issues, says Anchorage Chief Medical Officer George Conway. He says the ash has the potential to coincide with smoke from the upcoming wildfire season.
They're both quite harmful if they're inhaled repeatedly or deeply, and they can contribute to both acute illness and chronic diseases.
Conway says residents can protect themselves by staying home as much as possible and wearing an N95 mask and protective eyewear outside. For NPR News, I'm Wesley Early in Anchorage.
Lawmakers in Colorado are proposing legislation that would create some of the most restrictive gun control laws in the country. The bill would outlaw the use of detachable ammunition magazines in most cases. Those are devices that allow shooters to reload and fire bullets more quickly. From member station KUNC, Lucas Brady Woods reports.
On a January morning in Lakewood, Colorado, just outside Denver, a steady stream of customers browsed the showroom at Bristlecone Shooting, Training, and Retail Center. Owner Brian Clark has been running the store for a decade.
Over the last 3 to 4 years, we feel like we've been under attack.
Over that time, Colorado has passed more than a dozen laws that gun ownership advocates say limit their rights. But Clark could soon be subject to those aggressive magazine restrictions. If the bill passes, it would be illegal in Colorado to buy, sell, and make most guns because of their detachable magazines. It would affect pistols and some handguns, but especially rifles and shotguns.
For our long gun inventory, 60 to 75% of the guns we sell would be affected.
That includes one of his best sellers, the AR-15. Here's what it sounds like attaching a magazine to one.
The Colorado legislature has definitely been making it much more difficult for dealers like ourselves, and they keep chipping away at our rights and our ability to make a living.
Other critics, including Colorado's Republican lawmakers, say the measure would be outright unconstitutional. But supporters say it's necessary to limit the damage inflicted during mass shootings. Colorado has a long history of those, dating back to Columbine in 1999. Fast forward to 2012, when a shooter used a 100-round detachable magazine to open fire on moviegoers in Aurora. Tom Sullivan's son, Alex, was one of the dozen people killed in that shooting.
If Alex had had 2 seconds, maybe he could have gotten behind the seat. Maybe something else could have happened in front of him, and maybe he'd still be here today.
The Aurora movie theater shooting was one reason Colorado passed a law more than a decade ago banning magazines that contain more than 15 rounds. But since then, two of the country's worst mass shootings happened in Colorado. At a Boulder supermarket in 2021, and at Club Q, an LGBTQ plus nightclub in Colorado Springs, a year later. Both involved high-capacity detachable magazines. Sullivan, now a Democratic state senator, is behind the latest gun control proposal. He frames it as a way to strengthen the ban on high-capacity magazines. It doesn't have any impact on guns people already own.
This is for the next purchase, and this is for the next person who becomes disgruntled at work or is being led down a path by some ideology out there. And when that person goes down to their local gun shop or big box store, they are going to buy something that's got an attached magazine to it.
Other states already have magazine restrictions in place. In California, magazines are supposed to be fixed, but the locking mechanism can still be removed in minutes with simple tools. Colorado would go even further and require them to be soldered, welded, or affixed with strong epoxy. Most Democrats support the measure, but they had to make some concessions to get Colorado's Democratic governor, Jared Polis, fully on board. One exempts several dozen firearms that are commonly used for hunting. Another would let people buy prohibited guns if they go through hours of safety training and get approval from their local sheriff. Daniel Webster studies state gun laws at Johns Hopkins University. He says even with the changes, the measure would create some of the country's strictest gun ownership laws.
Colorado could be a pioneer in true safety test for civilian firearm owners.
It's especially significant that it's happening in a western state like Colorado that has a deep-rooted gun culture, Webster says.
For Colorado to take this step, it would be more of a statement that it's important for there to be a more rigorous process for vetting.
Every Town for Gun Safety and Moms Demand Action are supporting the bill on one side. The National Rifle Association and other groups are lobbying against it. The bill may now have a clear path to the finish line in Colorado, but even if it's signed into law, it will likely face challenges in court. For NPR News, I'm Lucas Brady Woods in Lakewood, Colorado.
This is NPR News.
Anti-Semitism is up in the U.S., and the Trump administration says colleges are failing to address it. But some ask if the administration is weaponizing the fight against hate to suppress free speech.
One of the things that's important for our ability to combat anti-Semitism and other forms of hate is having strong democratic institutions.
That conversation tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, a new book by NPR's Emily Feng.
She was told by the Chinese government that she was no longer welcome in the country after reporting there for 7 years.
The time I had in China mattered a lot, and the stories that I was doing were important because if I didn't do them, would other people get to report on these issues?
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Violent attacks on Tesla dealerships are spiking from coast to coast, even overseas. The attacks started shortly after President Trump took office earlier this year and tapped Tesla owner Elon Musk to oversee a new unit in charge of slashing government spending and jobs. Tesla showrooms and vehicle lots have been targeted, along with EV charging stations. Here's White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
We certainly think it's despicable, the violence that has taken place against Tesla, the company, its employees, and also just Americans who have chosen to drive an electric vehicle. Many of them are Democrats, by the way. Democrats were big supporters of Tesla and of electric vehicles until Elon Musk decided to vote for Donald Trump. So we would like Democrats to also come out and condemn this heinous violence that we have seen. And I believe the Attorney General has said she's investigating these incidents as acts of domestic terrorism.
Authorities say not all of the incidents have been linked to politics, but there's been a definite uptick in attacks on Tesla since Trump took office. Vice President J.D. Vance will serve as the finance chairman for the Republican National Committee, a key fundraising role. NPR's Elena Moore says Vance is the first sitting VP to have the job.
Presidents and vice presidents typically have indirect influence over their party. So this role for Vance within the RNC is unconventional. To Republican strategist Ron Bongean, it sends a message.
It shows the importance the White House is placing on the midterm elections because historically, the party in power usually loses the House of Representatives to the other side in the midterm.
If Vance can be successful in his fundraising job, Bongean argues it could boost his resume ahead of a potential 2028 presidential bid. Though still years away, the vice president is currently considered a front runner in what may be a packed Republican presidential primary.
This is NPR. China says it's executed an unknown number of Canadian citizens for drug-related offenses, but China is not saying who it executed. Canada is asking for more information, as NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Canada said it asked for clemency in the cases, and neither Ottawa nor Beijing has released details about the executions. China does not disclose how many people it executes a year, but human rights groups estimate it is in the thousands. It is unusual, however, for China to execute foreign citizens. China has had rocky relations with Canada since 2018, when Canada detained a prominent Chinese tech executive at the Chinese company Huawei on behalf of the U.S. China then arrested two Canadians on espionage charges, leading to allegations from both sides of hostage diplomacy. And more recently this year, China and Canada slapped new tariffs on each other over electric vehicles and aluminum. Emily Fang, NPR News.
The Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates unchanged this month while signaling slower economic growth this year and next, with slightly higher inflation. The Fed still expects to cut rates twice this year, but predicts inflation will increase to 2.7% by the end of the year. That's well above the central bank's 2% target. Stocks finished higher today, the Dow up 0.9%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. It's that time again. Today, the Federal Reserve gave its regular report on how it's addressing inflation, more specifically interest rates. The Fed has decided to keep rates steady for now as the central bank waits for clearer evidence of how President Trump's tariffs will affect the economy. NPR's Scott Horsley has been covering all of this and has the latest. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so a lot of moving parts in the economy right now, but the Fed is standing still for now. What's going on?
Right. The Fed left their benchmark interest rate right where it was, between 4.25% and 4.5%. That sets the bar for all kinds of lending, including car loans, business loans, credit cards. Fed officials still expect to cut interest rates later this year by an average of 0.5 percentage point. But, you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty right now. And frankly, a lot of it's coming from the Trump White House. On-again, off-again tariffs and the threat of retaliation by U.S. trading partners has rattled the stock market. It's put a dent in consumer confidence. And it's left Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues in kind of uncharted territory.
It's really hard to know how this is going to work out. In the meantime, it's really appropriate to wait for further clarity. The costs of doing that, given that the economy is still solid, are very low.
Fed officials think Trump's tariffs will push prices higher, but they don't know by how much or what the ripple effects might be. Powell notes last time Trump was in office, he slapped tariffs on washing machines, for example, but not dryers, and the price of dryers still went up.
Oh, weird. Okay, so there's a lot of uncertainty, but where do Fed officials think the economy might be going?
Yeah, they put out their best guesses this afternoon, and they're projecting somewhat higher inflation and somewhat slower economic growth than they were 3 months ago. That could put the Fed in a tricky spot. You know, with higher inflation, the central bank would generally want to raise interest rates.
Right.
With slower growth, they'd generally want to lower interest rates. So this could be a kind of tug of war. Anecdotal surveys of consumers and businesses right now show there is a lot of nervousness out there. But Powell says that's not always a good guide to what people's actual behavior looks like.
There have been plenty of times where people are saying very downbeat things about the economy and then going out and buying a new car. But we don't know that will be the case here. We will be watching very carefully for signs of weakness in the real data. Of course we will.
Powell says the risk of recession does not look particularly elevated right now, and financial markets seemed reassured by that. The Dow rose almost 400 points today.
But I have to ask, President Trump hasn't been shy about pressuring the Fed when he wants to see lower interest rates. Is Powell worried about that?
Yeah, Powell has carefully guarded the Fed's independence, but he has also tried to keep a low profile and avoid antagonizing the president. Mm-hmm. Just yesterday, Trump fired the two remaining Democrats on the Federal Trade Commission, who, like the Fed, was set up to be insulated from the White House. The ousted commissioners have promised to challenge their dismissal in court. One of them, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, says this is a fight that matters for the Fed.
If the president can remove FTC commissioners, he can remove members of the Fed. This is not just about the stability and law enforcement without fear or favor at the FTC. It's about the stability of our institutional structures of government, including those that protect monetary policy.
Now, the Supreme Court ruled decades ago that FTC leaders can only be removed for cause, but the president is eager to see the high court revisit that standard, and supporters of an independent Fed will certainly be watching.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
Spring cannot come soon enough for poet Amy Gersler. She spent the winter waiting for the first day of spring, which officially starts tomorrow.
I anticipate spring from the moment fall starts happening.
Gersler has won a Guggenheim Fellowship. Her 14th book of poetry comes out next month. One of the poems is about this change of season. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
Here's Gersler reading the poem called Anticipating Spring.
Anticipating spring. Mosses, pollens, and grasses tune up. Can you listen without needing to speak? That fox wants to tell you something. Drunk on crumbs of the dead, roots sing. Blossoms ache to flash their panties a la can-can girls. Scholars mumble, pages crumble, wild parrots scream between rainstorms. Slow-growing saplings groan. Don't pray aloud. Just wish from inside your hideout of silence. Ah, goddess, please touch me.
This spring is a bittersweet one for Amy Gersler. Her home in Los Angeles was not damaged by the California wildfires, but her best friend's home in Altadena was burnt away to nothing.
So she's going out to the site and nurturing the things that are starting to grow on her blank, ashy lot now.
Even in Southern California, where early spring is subtle, she says she and her friend find hope in signs of new life.
Stuff is growing. Green things are starting to come up through the layer of ash.
The ash will dissipate, the world moves forward, and there's pleasure right now, she says, in knowing the longing for spring will soon be satisfied. Amy Gersler's new book is called Is This My Final Form? Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
The writer and producer David Stephen Cohen has died. While he wrote for live action shows in the 1990s like Pee-wee's Playhouse and Living Single starring Queen Latifah, he's best known for his work writing for animation. He worked on the screenplay for the 1995 animated film Balto.
Balto.
It was based on the true story of a husky that delivered life-saving medicine through a blizzard to Nome, Alaska.
And if you grew up in the 90s, one of Cohen's shows just might have left a mark on your childhood.
We interrupt this program to bring you Courage, the Cowardly Dog Show, starring Courage!
Cohen was the head writer for Cartoon Network's animated show Courage, the Cowardly Dog. It followed the heroic efforts of a, well, cowardly dog trying to protect his humans from some pretty scary paranormal happenings in their desolate town Nowhere.
Creepy stuff happens in Nowhere. It's up to Courage to save his new home.
For many kids, the show was goofy.
I gotta get help!
But also their first introduction to horror and the thrill of watching something that was terrifying.
I know I shouldn't.
David Stephen Cohen was part of the team that premiered Courage the Cowardly Dog in 1999, right before bedtimes. Oh boy. In the 9 p.m. slot. It was the network's highest rated premiere and ran for 4 seasons.
Cartoon Network honored Cohen on Instagram, writing, quote, "Thank you, David, for your work on the strangely beautiful world of Courage, lovingly adding to our childhood trauma while teaching poignant life lessons. How you've brought to life a scared but courageous little dog reminds us that we can do anything, even if we're afraid." David Stephen Cohen was 58 years old. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. With the Trump administration trying to lay off tens of thousands of federal workers, some Democratic governors are sensing an opportunity. WESA's Tom Reese reports they want fired federal workers to apply for state positions.
At a recent job fair in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed an executive order directing state agencies to consider federal experience on par with state experience. It's a move that he hopes will fill nearly 6,000 open positions with the state for registered nurses, civil engineers, and accountants.
If they're qualified and they want to serve Pennsylvanians, well, hear me on this. We want you on our team.
Like Shapiro, Hawaii Governor Josh Green.
I'm fighting to make sure people who lose their jobs can get a job through Operation Hire Hawaii.
And New York Governor Kathy Hochul.
Come join our New York State family.
have announced campaigns to appeal to federal workers who are new to the job hunt after sweeping government layoffs. Pennsylvania is home to more than 100,000 federal employees, and it's unclear exactly how many lost their jobs since Donald Trump took office. But in its first week tracking former federal applicants, the Pennsylvania office in charge of hiring says at least 700 people disclosed they used to work for a federal agency, and they've applied to over 1,000 positions. But not all federal employees say they're ready or even willing to go back to government agencies.
Oh, geez, I have to figure out what to do next.
Megan Schwob, a former U.S. Forest Service worker, was laid off in February in Oregon. After what she says has been nearly a month of uncertainty, she moved back across the country and home to Minnesota. She'll soon start a job in the private sector, despite calling the Forest Service her dream job.
I think damage has kind of been done for a lot of people who, it's been a couple weeks now, where people have really had to find new jobs and start new lives.
She says in her case, there might not be a job at the state level that matches what she did to maintain national forests.
There's just not as much correlation from the couple million acre public land to a smaller state-run park or facility.
Salaries likely differ too, says Philip Glover, who heads the union, the American Federation of Government Employees, in Pennsylvania and Delaware.
Usually the state is a little lower starting salary. It depends on the job, obviously.
But Republicans in Pennsylvania have expressed concern about hiring federal workers fired for poor performance. That's what many of their termination letters say. Republican State House Leader Jesse Topper says it comes down to efficiency.
Sometimes that doesn't take more people. Sometimes that takes less. But whoever we have in those jobs certainly need to be competent and doing their jobs efficiently.
Glover, with the union, says actually working for the federal government is a pre-qualification for working for the state.
Clearly, these were political terminations. These weren't for cause.
More than 500 employees in his local union have filed for unemployment. And he says many are waiting to see what effect judges' rulings have on reinstating some agency workers. As far as Pennsylvania, Glover says,
I think the governor stepped out there and did some things that some of the other states aren't doing, and we appreciate his willingness to do that.
The AFGE and other federal unions will monitor judges' rulings on whether workers can have their jobs back, and states will keep trying to entice feds to work for them instead. For NPR News, I'm Tom Reese in Harrisburg.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. In 2022, journalist Emily Feng was told by the Chinese government that she was no longer allowed back in China. This after she had lived in Beijing and covered the country for 7 years. Feng was born and raised in the U.S. to Chinese parents, and she says Chinese officials told her that they considered her inherently Chinese. But she was later labeled as a race traitor by Chinese state media for her work. What does it even mean to be Chinese in President Xi Jinping's China? Well, that is a question that Emily takes on in her new book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom. My NPR colleague and friend, Emily Feng, joins us now. Hi, Emily.
Thanks so much for reading my book, Ailsa.
You're so welcome. I loved it. Can you just start with, like, why has controlling Chinese identity become so central to Xi Jinping's idea of a powerful China?
I think it's part and parcel of how China thinks of itself. And it starts with your citizens. It starts with trying to make them functional, productive members of your society. And in the China that I increasingly covered in my later years in Beijing, it was a Chinese person who was Mandarin-speaking, who was heterosexual, who was loyal to the Communist Party, which basically rules China, even though there are other political parties. And there was less and less room for other diverse ways of being, whether right. that was political or ethnic or cultural. And
ethnically speaking, the ideal Chinese citizen, according to Xi Jinping, is Han, right?
Or culturally Han, which is the majority ethnic group in China. There's 55 other ethnic groups, but Han, far and away, is the most populous. And I'm Han Chinese.
And so am I.
Yes. And all the stories that I loved covering the most for NPR in China were about identity in some way or another. And so I was looking for a way to delve more deeply into that theme because I came to see how it influenced domestic policy, national security policy, and increasingly how China perceived its relations with other countries.
Yeah, I mean, your book raises so many examples, so many stories of individuals who don't fit into Xi's ideal of what is Chinese. And for me, one of the most fascinating stories was about the Hui minority group. Like, physically, you point out, they're pretty much indistinguishable from the majority ethnic group, Han Chinese. But Hui people are predominantly Muslim. So to Xi Jinping, that means they're not really, truly Chinese, right? Can you talk about, like, what does the story of Yusuf tell us about how the Chinese government connects religion with ethnicity?
So Yusuf is one of my main characters. He's actually one of the people who gives the book its title. And he's a Hui Muslim man. He becomes a kind of born-again Muslim. And like many of the characters in this book, I only use his first name because a lot of them were still living in China when I was writing this book, and I wanted to make sure they didn't experience any retribution for being in my book. For those who don't know about the Hui in China, they're one of the biggest Muslim groups in the country. And they've always had this in-between state because they present as very Han Chinese. They're very, very much in the mainstream. They're very active in trading circles, in translation and academia in China. And yet they're in this in-between space because they're known for being Muslim. That's basically their only identifying characteristic that binds them together as an ethnic group. And as Yusuf explores his Muslim identity, he starts to encounter the constraints of, well, are you Chinese or are you Muslim? And he spends his entire life trying to make the two compatible, only to, not to give too many plot spoilers, realize that he can't thread that needle.
Yeah. It was so interesting, too, because you point out Hui and Uyghur people in China. They see so many differences between themselves, even though both groups are primarily Muslim and therefore, in the Chinese government's eyes, similarly suspicious, right?
Right. So I start telling the story of Uyghurs who have undergone terrible, terrible crackdowns and detention campaigns in the last decade in China. But at the start of this crackdown on the Uyghurs, a lot of the Hui people who I was interviewing or in touch with about things like religious freedom and diversity saw their issue as completely separate from Uyghurs. And so this kind of divide and conquer thing was very interesting, how people saw their own identities within the melting pot that is China, and then starting to realize actually all of our issues in some way are connected.
Yeah. Well, I want to now turn this to you, Emily, and talk about how identity politics personally impacted you. Because when you were covering China as a journalist living in China, you were labeled by Chinese state media as a, quote, race traitor, someone who aligned with a, quote, unquote, hostile foreign force, meaning the United States. And You were also called, I didn't know this until I read your book, I think this one is so funny, the state media called you a banana, meaning yellow on the outside, white on the inside. What did it feel like to be accused by the Chinese state of not being Chinese enough?
So I tried so hard not to make this book personal. And of course, eventually...
It was fascinating when you made it personal.
I realized through writing this that one of the reasons I was interested in the topic of identity is it is a personal subject to me.
Yeah.
And so I started writing about more of my own experience. And on the one hand, I am proudly culturally Chinese, but I definitely bristled against being expected to perform a certain way because I was an ethnically Chinese, Mandarin fluent speaking reporter based in China for an American outlet. Mm-hmm. But it put me in this, again, weird limbo space where I think different parties expected different things of me, and it was impossible to fulfill the expectations of any side. And then U.S.-China relations became very, very tense, basically as soon as I started the job in Beijing. And that added a very real personal risk as well, a lot of pressure in reporting on the ground in China.
So when the Chinese state media was denigrating you for not being Chinese enough, did that in any way change the way you covered China as a journalist, knowing that the government questioned your very intentions, your very authenticity as a Chinese person?
It definitely lit a fire underneath me. It made me feel like I had limited time there, that the time I had in China mattered a lot, and the stories that I was doing were important because I didn't know if I'd get to do them again. If I didn't do them, would other people get to report on these issues? Yeah. So it made my time there extremely meaningful, and I still hope to go back to China one day as a journalist. It's a country that I still find fascinating and whose people I very much care about.
Well, how much did being a journalist in China, in a place with such abundant diversity, in the face of intimidation by the government, how much has that shaped you and the way you see yourself as a Chinese woman? Has it shaped your own identity?
It's made me much more proud and self-aware that I was born to parents who are Chinese. It's a language that I've worked really, really hard to master, and it's a world that will never leave me. That's also part of the point of this book, is that being Chinese is not confined to the boundaries of the People's Republic of China. There are so many Chinese diaspora creating new cultural products in the Chinese language, outside of China, even outside of Taiwan. And that connection and those people and that world will always be accessible whether or not I am in China.
Emily Feng's new book is called Let Only Red Flowers Bloom: Identity and Belonging in Xi Jinping's China. Thank you so much, Emily. I so enjoyed this.
Thank you so much, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D.